The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday morning California time space show program. And I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. And we appreciate your being with us tonight. And I believe we'll have a very interesting and informative discussion about a part of physics that no matter how many times we've discussed it on the space show, I'm still confused. So maybe if I am, some of you out there are confused as well. First, a couple of quick announcements. There will be no program on Sunday or Monday due to the President's holiday weekend. We resume Tuesday evening on the Space Show. And then we have an out-of-sequence program Wednesday evening with Matt Billy on his whale tracking with microsatellites. We had a streaming computer failure last week, and we were unable to do the program as planned, so we have that coming up this Wednesday at 7 p.m. California time. And then finally, today is a 60-minute format program, excuse me. So please watch your clock and the time. If you do have an email or a phone call that you would like to get into our guest, don't wait until the last minute, and make sure you do it while we're still on the air. Again, we're doing the 60-minute format today. So our toll-free phone number for those of you who would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223. And remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient, let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Email, if you choose that route, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can also post comments or ask a question via our blog, and that is thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right is the upcoming show menu. And click on the first show listed, that is today's program. That's also our blog and archive page, by the way. So open it up, and comments are down at the bottom, as always, with a blog page. You do not have to be logged in to discuss to make a comment. You can do so as a guest or visitor. And as soon as you post your comment, I will get a copy of it and can bring it up on today's Space Show program. Of course, putting comments out on the archive show, they're not live, so hopefully others will join in with whatever your question or your comment has to be. So for today, a couple of other things to pay attention to. Our newsletter goes up Sunday, even though it's a holiday, so you'll see all that we have planned for next week. Sunday, as the new website newsletter is posted on the website, and then Monday, as always, our email newsletter will go out at 6 a.m. California time. And remember, everything we do is archived, so you can either listen to programs right off of our website or very easily and quickly download them. Don't forget our store up on the upper left menu under support. You'll see Cafe Press. And we're introducing three new items that you may be interested in. I'm interested in them. I'm going to buy one of each for myself. I'm not going to tell you what they are, but they probably will be up on the Cafe Press website by this weekend. And part of that will also appear on the website, most likely this weekend as well. And then there's another really important button, upper left, Listen Live. This tells you how to listen to live shows, compressed MP3 archive, and podcasting shows, including Alexa by everyone's favorite Amazon. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them and help troubleshoot, especially on the podcasting side, if you are having a difficulty, just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com and let me know. Please share the Listen Live information with others that may be interested in this topic or space. And then also remember, we're a listener-supported program. That means that you, the listener, through your financial contributions, help keep the Space Show on the air. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. Without your gifts, we would not be doing this program. Remember, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your charitable gift. If you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction in California. We're classified as a public benefit corporation. California always has to do things a little different, right? So we're a public benefit corporation in California. Visit our parent, 1ONE, GiantLeapFoundation.org, for more information. While you're there, over on the far left menu, click on Team, and then there'll be a drop-down menu, and then click on the advisory board. Check out the guidelines if you're interested in being on our One Giant Leap Space Show advisory board, and the guidelines are okay with you. Please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. So I'm very happy today to introduce for the first time Dr. Will Dawson, and he is a staff member in the physics division at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. And he uses the cosmos to determine the properties of dark matter and the nature of dark energy in particular. You can read his full bio, which I have posted on the website, the Space Show website page. His research interests are dark energy, dark matter, merging galaxy clusters, weak gravitational lensing, X-ray astronomy, optical astronomy, large-scale structure of the universe, and more. Again, I've got his bio from Lawrence Livermore National Lab up on the Space Show website. Please read it when you have a moment. And he's more interested in dark matter than dark energy. We're going to ask him why. Dr. Dawson, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
Oh, thank you for having me, Dr. Livingston. It's my pleasure to be here.
David is fine. So,
okay, thank you.
So before I ask you specifics about your interest area, introduce us to dark matter and dark energy. As I said, I'm in a perpetual state of confusion about the two. So help us clarify what each is.
Well, I think your confusion is common, and part of it's due to perpetually bad, poor nomenclature that astronomers and physicists decide to give to new things. Let's start off with dark matter, because that's historically also what we had the first inclination about, and that started with Fritz Zwicky back in the 1930s. And so dark matter, its name actually, dark in this case, it means that it doesn't emit light like other matter that we're familiar with, such as baryons, which humans and our tables and bones are made of. And so why he first suspected that there was dark matter was that whenever he looked at galaxy clusters, and these are clusters of galaxies, and it's got hundreds to thousands of galaxies all gravitationally bound and orbiting one another, he measured their velocity. And much like a kid on a merry-go-round, if you spin it too fast, right? We all did this as a kid. You would spin off, and because the centripetal force would cause you to try to keep going in a straight line, and you'd eventually fly off the merry-go-round the faster it spun. Well, he found that these galaxies were spinning around so fast that whenever he added up all of their mass and estimated their gravitational force, the force that's pulling them towards one another, that velocity was too fast, and that their gravitational attraction towards one another was not enough to keep them from flying apart. And so he hypothesized then that, well, there must be some other form of matter that's not emitting light. So some dark matter that's increasing the gravitational pull of all of these galaxies towards the center of this galaxy cluster. And so that's really what dark matter is. Dark matter is similar to all the other matter that we know, like the Earth and the Sun, and that it has a gravitational attraction, and it causes a gravitational attraction to itself and other ordinary matter, but it doesn't emit light, such as the other matter that we're familiar with, which means that it doesn't, in more fundamental terms, it doesn't experience the electromagnetic force. It has no interaction through the electromagnetic force. And so that's dark matter, in a brief summary. Dark energy is very different, actually, and it actually has the exact opposite effect. So dark matter is like matter, and it pulls things together through gravity. Dark energy is very different. And the reason that it's named dark is actually more to deal with the fact that we don't really know what it is, and so we're kind of in the dark about it. But dark energy is this energy density that permeates space, and it seems to be relatively uniform, unlike dark matter, which can clump together and cluster and form structures in the universe. Dark energy appears to be relatively uniformly distributed throughout space. And what it does is it actually has the opposite effect. It causes things to repel, or in a sense repel. What it's doing, though, is it causes space to expand. And so the more space there is between two objects, the more dark energy will actually cause those two objects to expand. And this is why, as we sit here on Earth, we don't really experience, and we're not familiar with dark energy, because there's so little space actually between us and things like the Earth. And this is why dark energy doesn't cause us to accelerate away from the Earth. However, as you start looking at galaxies, there's vast amounts of space in between galaxies in the universe. Dark energy starts to become important. And as that space increases, the force of dark energy, this effect of dark energy, actually trumps the force of dark matter, which is acting to pull everything together, this gravitational force. And then so you start to see galaxies accelerating away from one another. And this is how we first discovered that dark energy was something that was existing in the universe as we went out and we measured the movement of galaxies over vast distances. And we did so through supernovae, exploding stars. We were able to identify that galaxies are actually accelerating away from one another, which is contrary to everything that you would expect through just our regular understanding of gravity. And so that's a brief intro of dark matter, which is causing things to accelerate towards one another through the gravitational force, and dark energy, which is causing them to expand away from one another and accelerate.
But if you don't really know what dark energy is, if it's kind of a mystery, I guess you know what it is, what it does, but you don't know what it is. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
And so now I know why I'm totally confused.
That's right. And you know, physicists and astronomers are confused as well, in that we really don't know exactly what it is. So there are there's theories out there that it's just kind of uniform energy density. There are other ones... So that it could be like a scalar field. So theoretical models, and there are other models that you've got quintessence, and so you can have dark energy, instead of being spread evenly throughout space, actually clustering in particular areas. There are other theories where, interestingly, if you want to get even more confused, you can have dark energy and dark matter coupled to one another. And so the distribution of dark matter affects the distribution of dark energy. And so part of it is we just found out about this a couple decades ago as we were studying supernovae and their expansion rate. And we were all completely surprised whenever we found that the galaxies were accelerating away from one another. Because this is baffling as to why this would happen into our standard model of physics, where, right, this is the equivalent of a kid playing with a ball, throwing it up in the air, and instead of it slowing down as it goes up and then accelerating back down towards you, this would be you throw the ball up and it accelerates faster and faster away from you. So we were all very surprised about dark energy as well.
Why did you decide to focus on dark matter over dark energy, and does anyone focus on both equally, or is it always one or the other?
Yeah, so I was equally interested in both whenever I started. But as you find, each problem is so nuanced in its own right that if you really want to do it justice, and if you're a mere mortal like me and not a genius, then it really does take complete dedication to one over the other, I think, if you want to make full progress. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people out there who study both and study both equally. And so, in particular, there are some theorists and also some observers as well. But the real thing here, and the reason why you can actually work on both, is with dark energy, the way that we get at dark energy and our best way of measuring it is going out and measuring the distribution of matter and the structure of the universe and how that evolves with time. Because, as I said, dark energy, as things get more and more space between them, dark energy acts to cause those objects to accelerate apart. And so, on different scales, and again, as we get to smaller scales where we get to the Earth and us on the Earth, dark energy plays essentially no effect whatsoever, or no discernible effect. So as you study these scales of matter and how they are distributed over the universe, that's the best way of getting at dark energy. And so it's somewhat related because you need to study the distribution of dark matter to be able to get it at dark energy. And so a lot of people who study dark energy will study dark matter in that regard. Now, I decided to go a little bit further and start studying the nuanced details of dark matter. So beyond just how it's distributed in the universe, but actually what's the underlying physical model of dark matter. And the reason why I decided to go after this was I thought, honestly, it seemed a little bit more attainable than getting at the nuanced details of dark energy in the near term. Now, maybe I was mistaken because it's still not easy to study dark matter, and every time we seem to have some insight into it, we actually start to rule out more of what dark matter could be than what it actually is.
But you do know what dark matter is, unlike dark energy. Is that also correct?
No, so this is I thought that this was the case too back whenever I started my career as an astronomer 10 years ago. People had really settled on this idea of dark matter being what's weakly interactive massive particle, or a WIMP. It's got this acronym of a WIMP. And they had even, you know, they were pretty confident that it was some supersymmetric particle, which is just an expansion of our standard model of physics. And so it was some new particle, but it was a new particle that we had, you know, a pretty nice particle physics model for. And so we were so confident that it was this weakly interactive massive particle because it fit our observations well, and we had some nice theories for this, that we started building all of these experiments here on Earth to detect this particle. And the reason that we could do this was these WIMPs, or weakly interactive massive particles, were hypothesized to interact through the weak force. And so this, unlike the electromagnetic force, which prevents you from falling through your seat and your hand from going through your table, the weak force is, as it says, a much weaker force. And so you actually have to get particles very close to one another to experience this force. But every once in a while it would happen. And so how we started searching for these dark matter particles, these theorized WIMPs, was by building large vats of things like liquid xenon, and then staring at this liquid xenon from all directions using what are called photomultiplier tubes. But all they do is they just take a very small amount of light and make it a little bit brighter. And so we would stare at this and wait for the rare event of one of these dark matter WIMPs to hit one of the liquid xenon atoms. And then whenever it would do that, it would emit a very tiny amount of light through what's called shrink-off radiation. Now, these experiments, you set them up, you stare at them, you try to eliminate all other sources of light so that whenever you see something, you're sure that it was a dark matter particle interacting with, let's say, the liquid xenon. And we set up all these experiments and many different forms of them, and what we've been able to do is we've been extremely successful at ruling out what dark matter can be. And in fact, most of the prominent WIMP models that we had have already been ruled out. Now, there's still room that it could be a WIMP, but we're starting to run out of space here in where these WIMPs could live and what's feasible of detecting. And so the other thing that was really kind of damning to WIMP was with the Large Hadron Collider. We expected to see signs of supersymmetry, this new extension of the standard model of particle physics with the Large Hadron Collider. But as of yet, we haven't seen any of these signatures. And so now physicists are left, you know, their favorite model has taken a few hits, and it's really forced us to start thinking about what else dark matter could be. So there are people thinking about axions, which are other cosmic particles. There are people thinking about, you know, maybe we don't necessarily know exactly what the dark matter particle is, but let's focus instead on what its physical properties could be. And so this is one of the things that I did, was with the merging galaxy clusters, is you can start to ask, is dark matter interacting with itself? And if so, that would give us some insight into the fundamental nature of it, even if we couldn't tell exactly what particle it was. The other thing that we've been forced to expand our horizons is we're now reconsidering whether or not black holes could be the dark matter particle. And regular black holes have largely been ruled out by microlensing experiments in the past, and some of those were conducted here at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. But one exciting avenue is that, are you familiar with LIGO and the gravitational wave experiment?
Yeah, we've covered that quite a bit, and we've had several guests over the years on that subject.
Okay, great. So just for the listeners who haven't, LIGO is detecting intermediate mass black holes. So these are black holes about 50 solar masses, or 50 times the mass of our own sun, that are spiraling around and merging into even more massive black holes. And so there's a theorist here at the lab, so George Chapline, who in the 1970s hypothesized that primordial black holes, these are black holes formed at the very earliest moments of the universe, that these could actually be abundant enough to make up the majority of dark matter. And so we're even considering now black holes, and we've got an experiment here at the lab, which I'm leading, which is searching to determine whether or not dark matter is actually these primordial black holes.
How do you confirm that?
Okay, so again, you know, studying dark matter is not an easy thing to do, no matter how you're studying it, because, again, it doesn't emit light. right? And so then how do you go out, for example, and detect black holes? Now, one way is as with LIGO. You wait for black holes to get close enough and merge together. Another way that you can study black holes is by hoping that there's another star next to the black hole and feeding it. And what happens there is that as that matter gets stripped off the star and sucked into the black hole, it emits X-rays. And so you can, these are called X-ray binaries. But what do you do if you've just got a black hole floating through space, right? I mean, there could be one passing right next to Earth at the moment, and we would be none the wiser. So how do you go out and detect these black holes? That's an excellent question. And the way that we're doing it is by using the fact that in general relativity, massive objects distort space and time. And so just as if you were to set a bowling ball on a trampoline, right, that massive object actually causes the fabric of the trampoline to distort. A massive black hole causes the fabric of space-time to distort. Now, that in its own right, you can't necessarily detect. But what you can detect is how that distortion of space-time affects light as it travels through that distorted space. And so how we are looking for these black holes at the moment is by staring at stars in the distant Milky Way, so stars far away from us. Some of these are in the center of the Milky Way. And we study and we stare at millions to billions of stars in the Milky Way. And we're just looking at them, and we keep looking at them. And what'll happen is every once in a while, a black hole will pass in between the line of sight of us and that background star. And as it passes in between us and that background star, it's distorting the space in between us and that background star. And so what happens is that it'll actually act as what's called a gravitational lens. And that distortion of space will actually cause multiple rays to be bent and focused towards us. And so what'll happen is as we're staring at that star, with time, as the black hole passes in between us, it'll get brighter, and then it'll keep getting brighter until the black hole is right between us and that star. And then as the black hole continues to move away, the star will get dimmer, and it will return to its original brightness. And so this is called gravitational microlensing. And so by staring at these stars and looking for this characteristic rise or brightening and dimming of the star, we can actually infer that there was a black hole that passed in between us. And we can actually start to constrain properties about that black hole, such as its mass, how fast it was moving, etc. And if we do this enough, we can start to measure the abundance of black holes in the Milky Way, as well as their distribution. And if there are enough of those, then we can add up all the mass that we see from those and say, given our probability of seeing these events, there's enough mass in the ones that we've detected to infer that it must make up all of dark matter, or there isn't enough, and so these can't possibly make up all of dark matter.
And how often do you find these?
Yeah, so this is very rare. So, and in fact, the probability of detecting one of these events is about 1 times 10 to the minus 5. And so basically that just means about 1 in 10 million. And so...
How do you look for them? I mean, what's your process for trying to find them?
So exactly. Since these are so rare... Since these events are so rare, what you have to do is you just increase your odds by measuring more and more stars. And so since it's 1 in roughly 10 million to 1 in 100 million, if you stare at a billion if you stare at a billion stars, you're going to detect about 100 of these or so. And so it's all a numbers game. And so what this leads us to is it leads us to surveying very dense parts of the galactic plane, so where you have lots of stars and you can see lots of stars at the same time. And it also drives us to observing them over a long period of time. So the longer, again, the more stars you observe and the longer you observe them, the more likely you are to see one of these rare events.
I have a listener question for you.
Sure.
Todd, by email, is in San Diego, and he says, as a researcher in this area, I'm curious as to what your research goals are. It seems that all of this research is never-ending, and so long-term, you would be long gone off the Earth before any progress or maybe even any of your goals could ever be accomplished. So a researcher like yourself, what kind of goals do you set for your research that you're wanting to do and are able to do?
Oh, that's an excellent question. And it's, you know, it's the old standing on the shoulders of giants, right? I'm sure that at any point, so for example, Fritz Zwicky, you know, he proposed this idea of dark matter for the first time in 1935. It wasn't actually a serious scientific subject until Vera Rubin, many years later, measured a similar effect whenever she was studying galaxies. And so for Fritz Zwicky, he didn't actually see the realization. He never saw this field mature. He also predicted things like supernovae, and those were the very objects that, you know, I don't think he ever saw one, but or saw them used as scientific tools, but those were the very scientific tools that were used decades later to actually measure the expansion of the universe. And so I think that there's some satisfaction in just looking at the historical trends that if you can make progress, you may not make that breakthrough. And in fact, these breakthroughs, such as detecting the expansion of the universe and discovery of dark energy, are extremely rare. But if you make good progress in your scientific field and you can either confirm or rule out new ideas, then maybe that will someday lead to a major discovery or major breakthrough. Now, that's somewhat satisfying, but I also take a great deal of satisfaction in trying to construct problems that maybe are high risk, high reward. And so, but at the same time having guaranteed science. So let's take, for example, the case of the current project that we're doing looking for black holes that might make up all of dark matter. The high risk, high reward is that, you know, we really don't know what dark matter is, and black holes are only one possible theory to make up dark matter. And so what are the odds that black holes are going to make up dark matter? I would say, you know, not very good. It's a viable theory. And so if we make that measurement and we actually find out that they are dark matter, I mean, that would be revolutionary. And so even though there's some high risk because we're not exactly sure, and that's what makes it exciting to some regard, there's potential for high reward. Now, it's risky to have your career go that way because, you know, again, these are low odds, and so if your entire career goes that way, you might have a bunch of null results, which have value but aren't that exciting, and you can't publish a great deal on those. So what I like to do is I like to construct projects that also have essentially guaranteed results. So they've got a plan B or a fallback option that's still very interesting science and would progress a particular field, even if they're not revolutionary. So in the case of black holes, we still don't understand a lot about, you know, the death rate of stars and how many of those stars go into black holes versus neutron stars. And there's lots of interesting plasma physics, fundamental physics related to the birth and death of stars and the death of black. I mean, the death of stars and the birth of black holes or neutron stars. And so, by going out and studying black holes in our own Milky Way, we can actually gain insight into all that interesting physics. And so, even if we don't confirm that black holes are dark matter, and we don't have that revolutionary result, we'll still have interesting science to publish on. And so I always like to pursue scientific topics that way, so that there's always some satisfaction at the end of the day, and you can always, you know, progress one field or another.
I have another question for you.
Sure.
This is kind of weird format, but I'll play along with the emailer. And we have a call waiting, but let me do James in Philadelphia first. And he says, David, I hope you'll ask my email question in the order I'm putting it out here. I know you probably think this will be a joke, but now I'm really curious. The first part of my question to Will is, has supersymmetry been confirmed or rejected as a theory?
Okay, so it's neither been confirmed nor rejected. There's still some models of supersymmetry have been rejected by the lack of discovery at the LHC. But again, supersymmetry and a lot of these physical models, they don't reside at one specific point in phase space. But actually, they could occupy a range of models. So whenever you say supersymmetry, there are different parameters, and how you tweak those parameters could still be a valid form of supersymmetry, but be different from one another. And so many models of supersymmetry have been ruled out, but there's still potential for supersymmetry.
Here's the second part of his question, which I think he's serious, so I'm going to ask it. If I thought he was just totally blowing us off, I wouldn't do it.
No,
He says, I'm a big fan of the TV sitcom The Big Bang Theory, and Sheldon, the leading physicist on the series, was going to win a Nobel Prize in his mind for his supersymmetry theory until Leonard and the gang were helping him do research on notes and footnotes and other documents, and they found a 1970s paper from a Russian physicist saying supersymmetry was a wrong and showed the proof why it was bogus and wrong. So I'm curious if things like this on shows like this have any accuracy to them. Are they totally fictional by the writers, or could there possibly be any truth buried in the comedy?
Yeah, in this particular case, I don't know about... I don't know if there exists this paper, and so I'm not familiar with that. So I can't answer that specific case. But in many cases, this does happen, and this is part of the whole point of doing research, is actually, and that's where the name comes from, is you're kind of researching what others have done. So others did some search, and you're researching what they did. And so I found this happen before in my own career, where I come up with an idea, and, you know, I think it's pretty good, and so I start to flesh it out a little bit. And then you start researching, and you find out, you know, that someone else did it 20 years ago. And this has happened to me a number of times, which, you know, I think is a natural progression, just because there's so much knowledge out there that it's impossible to hold that all in your head at one time and know it all. And so even though we go to school for, you know, many years to get a PhD, it's just impossible to fully hold an entire field in your head. And so I think this is an important aspect, and it happens all the time. And so it's not a bad thing to actually come up with a theory, flesh it out a little bit, but it's also important to go out and do that search. And then oftentimes what you'll find is that, hey, this was largely done by this other person, but I had a new tweak on it. And so let me reference their work And sometimes it's disappointing because you think you've come up with something brilliant and you find out that someone else has already done it. That's happened to me. And it's actually happened to where there's Gary Bernstein and Tony Tyson. Several times, these two researchers, they've led the field of gravitational lensing for a number of years, and so I think I have something clever. And even though I'm familiar with both of them, I go back and I search and I find that, oh, you know what, they actually did this in the 80s. And so the other part of his question, I think, even though, you know, so the Big Bang Theory is great because, you know, it keeps drama and it's a bit exaggerated, which makes it interesting, because if you just went out and looked at a scientist's life on a daily basis, it would, you know, sometimes it's exciting, but for the most part, it's sitting in front of a computer. But I know that the show consults with other physicists, and I know some of these physicists. And so they try to actually have a basis in physics. And so some of the equations that they have up on their board in their apartment, I've noticed before. And I'd say, oh, I recognize that equation. And so they actually do try to have some grounding in physics, but at the same time, they take some literary license to make it more interesting, which I think is fine.
I'm a big fan of the show. I actually watched the one that our friend is talking about, who knows? But they do it in such a comedic way that, you know, do you really want to believe this is real science or not? That's another question, but... yeah, they do have consultants, so just to even come up with the idea of supersymmetry, somebody's out there guiding them how to do that.
And there are truths in many of the scenarios, even though they're not exactly true. Similar type things, often happen to maybe a less comedic degree.
But I've interviewed over the last 19 years many, many scientists and physicists, and I have yet to find one of the personality of the guys on the Big Bang Theory. So that may be rarer than a black hole. I don't know. You do have a phone call. Hi,
sure.
Caller. Welcome to the Space Show today. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John. Nice to talk to you again.
Yeah, I was noticed that your black hole theory has an interesting advantage in that you don't have to really postulate really exotic matter that's outside the standard model to have that be the solution.
That's correct.
Yeah, so that would be one advantage, at least from a theoretical point of view, from your idea, rather than coming up with some really exotic theoretical constructs that...
Well, it depends who you ask. If you ask a theoretical physicist, some of them might be quite depressed if that were dark matter, because we always... And that was one of the... That was one of... You know, I'll go so far as to say some people were depressed by the results of the Large Hadron Collider, and that we haven't found something, you know, surprising. We found the Higgs, which was an amazing accomplishment. But I know some theorists who are really hoping for some real stumpers or surprises to come out of the Large Hadron Collider. And so to a similar regard, I think some theorists would be, you know, a bit disappointed if dark matter were just black holes.
Got sort of mundane, I guess, in that sense.
Although I will say that if black holes really are dark matter, then they have to be formed at the very earliest moments of the universe. And so even though it wouldn't be a new particle, it would give us a new window to the earliest moments of the universe, and actually one that we don't have right now. So it might actually tell us something new and fundamental about the creation of our universe.
Yeah. Well, one other thought I had while I was hearing you talking about that is that if they're formed in the early universe, is there a theoretical, at least hunch or ballpark as to what mass range these primordial black holes would be in?
Yeah, there is. And in fact, one of my collaborators here at the lab, George Chapline, who I mentioned earlier, he wrote a paper last year as part of our project showing that depending on when these objects form at what time they form in the universe, it basically defines the mass spectrum, or the range of masses that these black holes occupy. And so we have some constraints on what ranges these objects could be. And so if we were to measure the distribution of black holes and their masses at current day, this would actually tell us at what time, or give us some constraint, at what time they formed in the early universe.
Yeah, because you're mentioning we might not notice one going by us, but if that were the case, it would have to be a fairly low mass compared to what we normally think of in the stellar black holes from supernova explosions.
That's
right.
We
kind of notice it.
Yeah, it depends how close it gets.
I was wondering, because, I mean, the lower range would be the whole issue of problems where the Hawking radiation would be a factor to cause them to dissolve and go away, so it'd have to be big enough they would last into the billions of years of the present era.
That's a very good point, and in fact, that gives us one of the lower bounds on how small they could be. Also, the radiation that would come off of evaporating black holes, we don't see some of that radiation. And so that actually has enabled us to constrain the very low mass black holes. And so part of that is the reason that I and my collaboration are focusing on kind of this intermediate mass range of black holes.
Mm-hmm. So what magnitude is that? Is it from Earth mass or Jupiter mass or solar?
So the ones that we're focusing on now are in the mass range of like a few solar masses, so up to thousands of solar masses.
Oh, very heavy. Okay.
A very heavy one. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I was trying to pin down. All right, that's very interesting. I saw some, the Science Channel, I saw some things about these supermassive black holes on that a couple of weeks ago, I think it was a week ago, something like that. It was kind of interesting. Okay, well, I found that, so that's kind of what we're looking at. So that'd be a fluctuation of a very early expansion, wouldn't it, to create something that big?
Exactly. Yeah we're talking within the first second and even before, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. One other thing, kind of going back to the early part of your discussion, I kind of was interested in the whole issue that the kind of mystique of the dark energy issue. This historically was, it first showed up in Einstein's first cosmological studies, where he was looking at the cosmological constant to keep the universe static, which then was rejected once the expanding universe was discovered over a decade later. But so all of a sudden, it's kind of gone from just a constant in the general relativity to something that's considered to be more like a something, an energy or a field or something of that sort. Kind of, there's
yeah.
a transformation in thinking.
That's correct. And in fact, it was viewed as Einstein's greatest blunder that maybe wasn't a blunder.
Yeah, he might have got the Nobel for that and then found out it was still a little bit off or something. Got a second one. But, it's interesting, though, that But the thing I've understood is that the whole problem is when people try to come up with a theory of it, they generally come up with something massively off from what the real experimental number is. And that's one of the big problems, I guess you'd say, from the theoretical side of it.
So there's, again, these models, even the inflationary model, which seems to describe the evolution of the early universe. It's got parameters in the model. Just as Einstein's theory of gravity also has parameters. So all these theories have parameters associated with them. And depending on what you set those parameters to, they can create vastly different results. And in fact, that's one of the things, one of the powers of observations is actually enabling us to constrain those parameters. And we've done that, wonderfully so with the theory of gravity. And so now we have very tight constraints on the gravitational theory parameters. And we're trying to do similar things with dark energy theories and dark matter theories.
Okay, yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I'll let you get on with your presentation. It's been a pleasure discussing this with you.
Oh, well, thank you for calling in. Those are excellent questions.
Thank you, John. Listeners, there's still time if you would like to give us a call today, 1-866-687-7223, or send in an email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And I also want to take a brief second to thank our sponsors for the Space Show, the Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Moonwords, AIAA, the Space Development Organization, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan. So we thank all of those sponsors. We wouldn't be doing the Space Show this morning without their great support. Are there priorities set out for research in dark matter? Is there like a sort of a scientific community understood these are primary things to find out?
Both yes and no. And so for example, I and my fellow collaborators, we recently wrote a paper saying, okay, what are the science probes that the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, and this is an 8-meter telescope that's going to be built in Chile and survey, essentially half of the sky and do so over 10 years. So one of the things that we did with this paper was we said, these are the dark matter probes that LSST can do best. So let's focus on those whenever we use LSST. There are similar papers that have come out, for example, by the Department of Energy and the high energy physics community, and they try to inform policymakers of the scientific experiments that exist and the ones that are perhaps most primed to get good results, so that policymakers, such as those at the Department of Energy, can invest their money and actually taxpayer money most effectively. And so we try to be responsible, because you can't possibly do everything all the time. And we value the taxpayer support and the amount of support that scientists are given by the community and listeners like you. And so we want to treat responsibly. And so we try to come together and form a consensus as much as possible, which is very difficult in many cases, as to what's best to do. At the same time, scientists often have a large amount of independence in what they pursue. And I think that this is very important. So this is just as important as mutations and evolution, right? You need scientists, and you need some scientists out there who are coming at it with maybe new ideas, ideas that haven't necessarily been supported by the broader community. And this is extremely important. And so you need both, and you need a decent mix of both. And so I think it's good to get some consensus, and maybe that's what a majority of science experiments that should be funded do. But you also need a component where you've got scientists that are able to pursue some of these radical ideas that are a bit out of mainstream. But doing radical ideas in a responsible way, still with all the exact same scientific rigor as is required as with anything.
Sally is in Seattle.
Yes.
And she said, is there such a thing in your field as rogue physicists doing experiments that you might and others might classify as being pretty far out of the box and risky? We're seeing that happen, for example, with cloning in China. Does the same thing happen in physics?
Yeah, I think to a lesser degree, because, perhaps in physics, the broader physics, it's to a lesser degree in astronomy, right? There's you don't have a lot of the same controversial or immediate societal impacts that cloning has, right? I mean,
right.
We are largely observers of the universe, and we can infer physics from those observations, but we're not actually going out. If we could start making stars explode, then I think you would start to run into those. But we're nowhere near that capability. You also get, I think, people who are interacting with other solar bodies within our solar system. You start to run into these ethical considerations where a rogue physicist or a rogue scientist who's thinking about sending, a probe out to another world, we need to start to come to term and address those. Those are impactful. But in astronomy, you'll have people going out and pursuing rogue ideas. And in fact, this idea that black holes make up dark matter, whenever we first started it was relatively radical. People hadn't really been thinking about it a lot. They had largely dismissed it. But whenever you went back and you looked at the evidence that had ruled it out, there were a certain amount of assumptions made with many of those probes which might not have been true. And so it opened up the possibility, that you might have black holes as dark matter. And really the reason that we started to revisit this concept, which had largely been ruled out, was the discovery of black holes by LIGO. And these intermediate mass black holes, and it made us question again what assumptions we had made in the past. And so I do think that you have kind of maybe what you would call rogue or scientists who are pursuing some radical ideas, but I don't think that it has the same necessary concerns as you've got in fields like genetics. But that's an excellent question.
Paul is in New York, and he says you touched earlier on what kind of objectives or goals a physicist in this field might have, maybe including yourself. I'd like to ask you to make it a bit more personal. By the time you retire or you're no longer around, what do you hope your physics legacy will be, since you are so focused on dark matter?
Oh, that's an excellent question. There's the stretch goal of making, again, a radical discovery. I think I find that exciting, the possibility of it exciting and highly motivating. So, of course, it would be incredible to make a radical discovery, but at the same time, to be a responsible scientist, you've got to separate yourself and your emotions from that whenever you're conducting the experiment, because there's the potential of biasing yourself towards a result. And a lot of this, this is called pathological science, and it's crept up time and time again in science, where well-intentioned scientists who aren't intentionally out to deceive people will actually allow themselves to be deceived because they want a result so much, or they want an outcome so much. Maybe they want to win a Nobel Prize. And so they'll allow themselves to actually be fooled or ignore some aspect of their experiment, which would greatly influence the conclusions that you would draw from the result. And so, part of me wants to, make a major impact, and I think that that's natural. But the realist in me appreciates that that's an unlikely event. And so one of the pleasures and things that I want to happen as I look towards the end of my career is that I was risky. I did take these risks, and I tried to find these radical discoveries. But at the same time, I was a responsible scientist and didn't make any false claims, but did perform good science. And in doing so, I realize, I'm probably not going to win the Nobel Prize. But at the same time, I want to look back at my career and realize that just as those who are ahead of me and who have mentored me to be a good scientist, I want to do the same for the next generation of scientists. And so mentoring postdocs, people who have recently received their PhD, younger students, such as graduate students who I'm working with now, and even undergraduates, I want to look back and say that I've mentored them and trained them in the right ways to be good scientists and to be willing to take risks to go for those revolutionary ideas but still be solid scientists. Additionally, I think it's very important one of the things that I want to see happen at the end of my career is that the diversity of the scientific community be broadened, because, you know, I come from a relatively fortunate position. My father was a state senator in Oklahoma. My mother was a professor at a community college in Oklahoma. And so I realized that I've been afforded many opportunities that many people haven't. And I think that played a large role in my ability to pursue this fascinating career. And so at the end of it, I want to try to increase the diversity, because I think that, again, the more diversity you have in a field, the more ideas that you come up with, the better practices you develop. And so I'd like to see that happen at the end of my career, too, and know that I played a part in that as well.
We're in Oklahoma. I'm from Tulsa. That's
Oh, you're Tulsa. I grew up in Seminole, Oklahoma.
Oh, okay.
Small town of 10,000, about an hour southeast of Oklahoma City.
Yeah, no, I've been there many times, or been through it, I should say. Many times.
Hello, Oakie. That's great.
What was the community college?
Seminole State College.
Okay.
So it was originally Seminole Junior College, but then about 20 years ago, they changed the name to Seminole State College.
Yeah, they got rid of junior college and went to community college or something else all over the country. I know that.
Yep.
What process do you use to avoid bias?
Oh, yeah, so this is a fine balance, because you want to remain excited because that's a strong motivator to carry out. But at the same time, you always want to be questioning yourself. You want to be questioning how you're interpreting those results. The other thing that is important to do is construct your experiment carefully so that you're less likely to fool yourself. And so this means building in cross-checks or cross-validation so that if you get a result, you have a way of checking it. And I think the important thing there is always being skeptical, and even of yourself and of your experiment. And again, this is a fine balance, because it's a competitive environment out there for funding, and so you have to be an advocate for your particular approach. But at the same time, you've got to take a step back all the time to say, is what I'm doing the most effective means of doing this, or is there a way that I could do it better, or is there another interpretation for these results? And I think the main thing is just being aware that we're humans, after all, and we're fallible. And if you're aware of that, then you'll always question it, and you're less likely to, I think, make one of these unintentional mistakes.
For my dissertation, of course, I was qualitative in the business school, but I had a fact-checking editor who constantly fact-checked and drilled me on assumptions, making me defend almost every assumption to avoid being totally full of Kool-Aid and all of that. But the interesting thing is, over time, much of what I wrote about back in 1999 and 2000 did not happen in commercial space, in the new space industry. There was only one or two people that pointed out, you know, that the mantra of the day was probably bogus. But everything I wrote about got approved by all my faculty members and dissertation people, who I think had more bias in their agenda than I had in what I was doing and what the fact checkers would allow me to do, because it all got approved and signed off on. So
you're right. Yeah, peer review is extremely important too.
Yeah, and the peer review is often loaded with bias. So, but I can't think of other processes to use. But one has to be aware of that, and whatever it's about, you need to be able to question yourself to avoid bias. So that's a big deal. We're a little over the one-hour mark. It's been a fascinating discussion. I don't think we've solved the problems or discovered dark matter. But hopefully you'll do another space show program and we can pick up the physics and keep going a little bit deeper and deeper if you're willing to do that. It's a fascinating discussion, and our listeners are interested in it, and we're all learning, and we thank you very much for your time.
Oh, well, thank you. This was an excellent forum, and I'd be happy to come back again.
Well, we'll talk to you again hopefully later this year, and if you come up with the big discovery, call us, and we'll put you back on right away.
All right. I'd be happy.
We'll help you break the news. I'll get the archives of this program to you as soon as possible, either later today or early tomorrow morning. And again, thank you very much, and we look forward to following what you're doing and to talking to you more on the Space Show.
Thank you, and thank your listeners.
Okay, and listeners, again, there is no show on Sunday or Monday due to the President's weekend, holiday weekend. And then Matt Billy with Tracking Whales Through Microsatellites at Booz Allen Hamilton will be with us Wednesday night. We built a special show given we had the computer problem, and he will be with us Wednesday evening, 7 p.m. California time. Everybody have a terrific, but most of all, very, very safe weekend, holiday weekend. Enjoy it, and keep looking up. Goodbye from Will, David, and the Space Show.